You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
My thanks to Nick Francona for coming on. Time to get the gunner on. So we'll see if the Skype thing works. He's not answering. You know, it's funny interviewing somebody who has who grows up the same way you do, and there's not that many people who grew up like I did. Well, there is, but you don't cross paths. The big separator is the Marine Corps, and I remember seeing that he was in the Marine Corps. I don't think I saw that he had been in the Marine Corps until he got out and went to work for the California Angels, and I saw a story about him. Talked about his time in Afghanistan. I was like, holy shit, man. I need to cross paths with that dude someday. And Nick came on today, and I wanted people to meet him and get to know about his background, you know, his service in the Marine Corps. And, we make commercials, and everybody kind of, you know, everybody kind of says, how hokey they are or whatnot. But, you know, you are changed forever. You're changed forever by a lot of things. And, and most of it is by the Marines you work with. And they're selfless sacrifice. And you see that, especially if you're fortunate enough to deploy to a war zone. And you see that, and it's it changed you forever, and that's not a joke. There's nothing, and then you go to different things and you hear stuff, and it does irritate you. You see people that talk out of both sides of your mouth and things like that, and if you could imagine, being part of professional baseball. There's no veterans hiring program. I mean, come on, how stupid is that? But you say you respect us, blah, 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 blah. Does the NFL have a veterans hiring program? I'd be curious to know. Does the NBA? Just a door that's open to veterans. Yeah, you got a fairly large pool to choose from. I'm thinking you could probably yank out some pretty incredible talent that's got some pretty incredible experience that might add to your organization. That's just me. Could be wrong, but I'm normally not. So, of 5,000 people, according to the statistics I've seen, of 5,000 people employed by Major League Baseball, 10 are veterans. Now, one of the pushback to that was, well, there might be more, but they don't want to... They don't want to come out as veterans. Why? Do they not want to come out as veterans? Are they afraid? Like, what will... Because it's embarrassing to be a veteran? That's a little odd. What is he doing? Hello?
What's up, man?
Are you kidding me? What's going on? Where were you?
What do you mean, where was I? I've been sitting here.
I've been calling since 11.
Don't try it, because this has a call off.
Oh, my God. You just walked in the house. You were in the garage. You forgot, didn't you? And then you looked down at the phone and went, oh, shit.
No,
you ran in here. Now.
This time, I've been sitting here since 11, or 10, actually 10:58. Because I was watching a video.
What were you watching? Oh, there you have it.
The video is almost 20 minutes into it now, so I have said. Yeah, interesting. Interesting video.
Nick Francona, son of Terry Francona, told me that he wasn't really sure, and his dad manages the Indians, so he's kind of has a vested interest, so he didn't really make a comment about the Red Sox going wire to wire. He said, I understand the sentiment because it's always resident in Boston after all the years that they went through where they didn't win. He said, but I don't think I should comment because I've got a dog in that fight. So, anyway, the had Major General Furness on today talking about what they're doing at Camp Lejeune. Wow.
All right.
Yeah, pretty. But you know what? If there's a place that you probably wanted to be located when something like that happens, it's a board of military installation that has redundant capabilities, a hospital, blah, 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 blah. So you open up the chow halls to dependents.
And it's always fun to watch.
Yeah, and you know,
kind of the buffoonery of people trying to be in charge,
right? And then you know, the Marines,
correct.
The civilian employees can't get there, so the Marines man the chow halls, and he said, so you know, you make it work, and you chainsaw the trees off the power lines, you get the power back up, and so it goes. So, but he said, yeah, the worst, for the surrounding area is coming with the water coming down the hill. So he said, well,
yeah.
We're dealing with it. So anyway, and the other part is the coming and going of units all of a sudden get stopped. Yeah, we got guys supposed to redeploy, but we can't take them here right now because we're non-functional. And then we got guys who are supposed to deploy, they can't deploy, so it throws a wrench into stuff. So anyway, so it goes. But interesting to have him on and hear his view of the whole thing. What email? Hey, Mac, is today the day we discuss the Gunner's new job more in detail, or is he going to shut it down again? Good interview with who? Nick Francona. What's that?
Who is that from?
This is from Vacaville Man. He wants to know about your job.
Bobby.
People are curious about, why don't you want to talk? Why don't you want to talk about...
Because it upsets me because you make fun of it.
Oh, well, come on. Everybody makes fun of it.
No, because, you know, you see, this is the line. Because you're making fun of people that are that's what you're doing.
You would have made fun of it, too. Right?
No, not
before you. Before you got into it.
No, let's just drop it.
No, all right. I'm just saying, you can make it smart about it. I don't know about it. I'm giving you a chance, and you're like, "No, I don't want to talk about it."
No.
All right. So what do you want to say?
I would, but I don't like the jokes.
Well, then, okay. Look. I promise you, no jokes. Tell us about it.
No, we're not gonna do it.
All right. So what do you want to talk about?
So what we were talking about yesterday was I saw a video today. And I didn't know this was actually on. It's on PBS. And it's the view of Amon Goth. He was the guy portrayed in Schindler's List as the camp commandant, the real brutal. I can't think of the guy's name.
Are we talking about Schindler's List again?
Yeah. So this lady, Monica Hartwig, talks about, her dad is Amon Goth. She was a little child in World War II, but she goes to watch Schindler's List and sees her father, and it completely, like, this ain't my dad. And so it got me thinking, like, you know, it's weird that we look at these people as monsters. There are probably people that thought of Adolf Eichmann as a pretty nice guy. So, like I said, it just made me start looking into, I was reading a lot about this, like, what makes these people, like, the things that he did for his daughter and his family, you would say he's a family guy. He's a nice guy. But now you see the atrocities that he did towards the Jews, and you're like, what is this? Is this some sort of bipolar? Extreme case of bipolar.
I saw a show on Netflix, I think it's called What Our Fathers Did. And it was, it's two sons. Their fathers were not German soldiers, okay? They were members of the Nazi Party, okay? And there's a difference, okay? So, and one of them accepts what his father was. The other one did not. And it's very, very interesting because they interview him separately initially, and then they interview him together. And at one point, there's a confrontation. And the one son looks at the other and says, why can't you accept that your father's a murderer, that your father was a monster? And the guy clearly is, you can see his turmoil with it. Like, you know, and he's not my, you know, not my,
yeah,
not my daddy, kind of. And I don't want to put words, because I don't know if he said exactly that, but it's pretty, pretty interesting. I was just, you know, title surfing in Netflix one night, and I saw that, and I watched it, and it was, you know, something I had never really given thought to, that you would, you know, you'd grow up and your father was killed in the war. That's what you heard. But these kids were old enough that when the one father was hung, you know, he remembered going to see his father for the last time. And they took him down to the cell that his father was in the prison in Nuremberg. And, you know, and he said, yeah, this is where, you know, he spent his last days, and he talks about saying goodbye to him, and he shakes his head. You know, his question is, why did my father go down that road? Because my father was a smart guy. Why did he go, what was it about my father that took him down this road of murder on an extent that, you know, is mind-blowing? And so it's really interesting. It's called What Our Fathers Did, a Nazi legacy. So really interesting stuff. So what's the takeaway from? Is there a takeaway?
It's just that, you know.
Is there something? Is there? Did you read that about her? Was it? Is there a?
No, program? Monica Hartwig. Yeah, of course she changed her name.
Right.
But it was a three-part PBS, I like PBS, documentary of the actual camp, the Plaszow in Krakow, Poland, where Schindler's Jews were. I thought it was, you know, I knew that the Schindler's Jews were a real thing, but I thought most of the movie, was fictitious, you know, to make, in order to tell a story about the Schindler's Jews. But no, I mean, the camps were real, the people, all the Germans, and the events were as real as they can get, which makes it, like, even more, like, man, shit. Crazy. And then one of the tags, you know how YouTube shows up next on the right-hand side when you're looking at it?
Yes.
So one of them, over on the right, I was watching this video, I looked over there, and I was like, oh, that's Band of Brothers. And it's called Examples of Winter's Leadership. And Examples of Winter's Leadership, Courage, and Leadership Values and Abilities to Lead, how it relates to school leadership. And then it goes through this whole thing of, when integrity is questioned by Sobel, Winters demonstrates his character. Remember Sobel? I hated that guy.
Everybody does. So when we talk about winners, we're talking about Dick Winters. We're talking about Band of Brothers.
Yeah, Dick Winters, who recently just passed away.
Yep.
He was a hero, and like he said, he wouldn't be called that, but he was part of the group of the first of the 506 Parachute Regiment, the Curry Boys, that, you know, landed at Normandy, or jumped into Normandy, and then fought all the way from Normandy, Bastogne, I mean, all the way up to the end of the war, man. These guys were in the thick of things. But this whole thing, and when Strobel,
yeah,
was chewing his ass because he's senior to him, and then at the end, he gets this when he's a major, and he's walking by, and he's a captain. He said, Captain Strobel, You salute the rank, not the man. That was a comment he said.
Right.
My favorite guy in all of Band of Brothers is Lieutenant. Who's the crazy lieutenant that they thought killed everybody?
Spears.
All the prisoners.
Spears.
Spears. I love Spears. But this is a neat little video snippet because it goes to, like, right now they're talking about Winters uses collaboration. He collaborates with his men to design and accomplish mission. He gets them involved. That's part of being a leader, you know, collaborate. Don't dictate. Winters demonstrates instructional leadership and influence. By leading courageously by example, and he effectively instructs and influences his soldiers by his actions. That's not seen much anymore. Usually, it's quite the contrary. And then it goes, the final part of this is Winters effectively uses vision. So, which is kind of weird because I didn't think of this, but it's actually good because it says Winters effectively uses vision. He formulates a strategy to put his vision into operation. So the little clip that they show is them running across the open ground where the Germans came across this field, and they just mowed it down. And then the last one, he's able to successful leader by effectively organizing soldiers using management. Again, pretty neat story. But Ronald Spears, that's his name, right? Lieutenant Spears?
Is Donald or Ronald, one of the two?
Ronald. When he's running across, man, like they're shooting, and he comes out of nowhere running through the smoke, like, with his Tommy gun, and everybody's looking at him, the inspiration that his men get. I mean, he just took over the platoon. No one really knew him.
Yeah, they knew him. He was a platoon commander in another platoon, and this guy, he takes over the company because this one guy, I think he was a West Point guy, but he was afraid, couldn't do it. And they're in around at Bastogne. And this guy he'd leave. He'd go back to the company CP. They'd be getting the shit shelled out of him. And in the movie, his name's like Walter Dyke or something like that. Where's Lieutenant Dyke? And he's never around. He's afraid. And then he has to lead an attack. And in the middle of it, he's getting guys killed because he freezes. And they send Spears in to lead, you know, Winter says, get in there, take over the company. He's a battalion commander, I think, at the time, or XO. And he'd send Spears in. And what Mike's talking about is,
there's Spears' decorations.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And the soldiers are watching him. These guys are hard. And you know what? And Mike and I talked about, would you rather be, is it more luck or is it good? Spears, man, they're watching him. He runs through this city twice.
under fire.
And he lives. You're like, holy shit, man. God is with him today.
Ronald Spears. The video is called Ronald Spears, Balls of Steel.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and he says
something. But it shows real pictures of him.
He says something, though, that I think after you've deployed to a combat zone and you come home,
wow.
You know, all the different things you see, all the things you think about, he tells this one kid who's scared, his name's Blythe, and he's experiencing traumatic blindness when he gets scared, right? And he looks at him and he goes, Blythe, until you accept the fact that you're already dead, you won't be able to function as a soldier. You need to accept that. You're already dead. We're just living here right now. And Blythe just looks at him. But we talked about, you know, it being out of your hands. I think it's life's easier once you accept that you're not in charge of whether you go home. Something else is, hopefully the medal misses you. You do your best to stay alive, but you see so many crazy things in terms of the way metal flies and guys, you know, and in my head right now is a cobra running, chasing a guy who set off an IED and then shot at us. And, you know, this dude running, the cobra shooting and stuff going everywhere. And this dude runs out of the dust. everything misses him. And you're like, are you kidding me? That was only about a bazillion rounds of Cobra ammunition, I don't know how much, exploding, and he doesn't get touched. And you hear that stuff. Band of Brothers has so much incredible leadership wisdom in it when you watch it.
Incredible.
Incredible. High definition, and it's in high definition too. And they do so many things well that are so, in my opinion, so subtle that I don't know who did the advising, but it was a bunch of guys that had been to war not once, but I think spent extended time there. To include the guy named Leapgott, somebody gets hit with a Panzerfaust, or by, I want to say, like a 47-millimeter gun or a 37-millimeter gun, as they attack into the town of Carrington. And the thing explodes as they're moving into the city, and Leapgott's like behind a wall, and this guy's just standing there stunned. He doesn't know what happened, and like half of his foot's gone, a huge chunk of his face. But he's got this look on his face that you'll never forget. If you've ever seen a look like this, you'll never forget it. And that is the look of like just kind of dumbstruck, like I don't really know what happened to me, right? I don't really know what happened to me. And Leapgott stands up and he says, "Come here, buddy." And you see this side of combatants that most people never see. This gentle, incredible side of guys taking care of each other. They just had the shit blown out of them, and you're sitting there going, like, that's a little bit too close to the inner sanctum, right? I don't know that I really want to watch that. But it's awesome stuff. Awesome stuff.
Did you see that link I just sent?
I heard it. I didn't exactly see it. You're bombing me with music. You can't watch. Let me tell you, I mean, Band of Brothers, hard to watch.
Yeah, I can. It took a long time to watch the whole thing because it was.
You have to stop.
You know, Pacific. You know, the thing is crazy is just the Marine Corps came out with one about Pacific. It was probably a year or 2 years later after Band of Brothers was released, and it did it really good justice too. However,
different.
Emotionally, it was different for me.
Yes.
Band of Brothers, because I think Band of Brothers. Went really after the whole thing, the Band of Brothers. You know, these are your brothers. These are the people you'll be forever changed with, you know. So it's...
I'm curious. Describe for me, and then I'll go after you. Describe for me the difference between Band of Brothers and the Pacific.
I think Band of Brothers, because it didn't pop around from... Pacific went from 5th Marines, 1st Marines, 7th Marines. I mean, it hopped all around, which was really neat because it showed the history of the 1st Marine Division, really. You know, that's why I was so hyped on it. It really went after it. The thing about Band of Brothers is it talked about just a small group of guys. That was it. And they sacrificed for one another. Again, I'm not saying that they didn't do that in another one, but this one, because... You see him go through, and you see, like I said, the leadership styles of these guys. I forget the guy who was a sergeant, became first sergeant, and then got battlefield commissioned as a lieutenant.
Corwin Lipton. First Sergeant Lipton. Then he gets commissioned.
Lipton. Yep. You know, guys like that, where they really kind of, you see them struggle, because Lipton had some problems at first. And Danny comes together. I mean, you see them grow as a unit, and then the losses that they suffer. I mean, it's like family members. I mean, it's worse than family members. It really takes you through this emotional roller coaster. And like you know, it came out first, I think, Band of Brothers, so watching it was more difficult, than it really was to watch the other Pacific, but, I think in their own right, they're two different stories telling two different things. But if you really want to watch Dick Winters, I would go to that guy every day, including twice on Sunday. I mean, he was something else.
Yeah, Dick Winters is, I mean, he gets it. He gets it. His responsibility, he gets his responsibility to his soldiers, and you know, and it's the show, all the it focuses on him and his leadership, and it's wonderful the way they sew him in right in real life. And then you see the guy who plays him is actually a Brit, I think, and
plays Dick Winters.
Yeah, I think he's a British guy named Damien something, and yeah, but he does a great job. I mean, you see the first rumblings of Winter's PTSD. He shoots this German kid who's a teenager in the chest and kills him after he sprints across his field leading an attack. And as he's typing up the report in another episode, he keeps seeing this young kid's face, scrub face, standing up. All of a sudden, Winters comes over this kind of elevated road. This kid's standing there, and Winters smokes him in the chest and kills him. But he made eye contact with him. You know, he makes eye contact with him, and you see him in his head. And so you see, I mean, which is what, you know, PTSD, a part of it is that videotape that rolls in your head, and you can't quite shut it off. I thought the difference, to me, there was uplifting parts in Band of Brothers. And Pacific was very dark, right? You know, the scenes of suicide, scenes of mental health, guys in cages, and the grim fight with the Marines and the Japanese, you know, on those islands.
Focused, like, yeah, on the cohesiveness of the unit.
Yeah, I thought there was uplifting parts even in combat with Band of Brothers. Pacific was dark and I'd say a tad depressing and grim. I thought they were very different, you know. Although they illustrated, you know, this, a lot of the same themes, I thought they were very different in the way they come across. The let me play this.
This chokes me up every time I listen.
Do you remember the letter that Mike Rania wrote me?
Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
You do? Do you remember how I ended it? I cherish the memories of a question my grandson asked me the other day when he said, "Grandpa, were you a hero in the war?" Grandpa said no. But I served in a company of girls.
Dick Winters. If you haven't seen it in a long time or spent a lot of time with it, then go bust it out again. I'd say buy it. I have it here, and you know, to me, the first thing, and well, I'll go back to Saving Private Ryan. My sons were watching it at the house one day, and they're like, "Hey, do you want to watch?" Because the sequence of, I was just looking at Steven Spielberg's IMDb, whatever file. Schindler's List comes out in 1993.
Really?
Yeah, that long ago. I wasn't quite sure of the sequence of it. Saving Private Ryan in 1998, and then Band of Brothers in 2001. So that's kind of the sequence of it. And one of the things I think that I saw Spielberg say is, in this kind of epic history, you don't need to sensationalize anything in it, right? If you just tell the story, the stories are so incredible The stories are so incredible in and of themselves. Here's a Mike just sent me another video of.
Well, don't play that. That's for you later. That's number one, I think.
This is the movie about Monica Hertwig talks about her father, Amon Leopold Goff. Yeah, can you imagine living with that? You know?
That your dad that you remember? I mean, so it's called inheritance, right. Which is like, wow, that's a pretty powerful. Yeah. You know, the legacy that he left her. And she talks about it. She goes, you know, I went to the movie, and I was watching the movie Schindler's List, looking for my father. And it was the opening scene where he's riding the back of the open convertible Mercedes, you know, and he's kind of cold, and he's like, you know, why is the goddamn roof down? I'm cold. Or roof down, yeah, I'm cold. You know, that's the opening scene, and she goes, there's my father, you know. And she has a hard time believing that her father was orchestrated these things. She was 11 years old. I mean, so she knew her dad. She has memories of him. You know, and I bet he came home and he was as he comes home, he has her bouncing on the knee, he's spending time with her. She doesn't see these things. You know? But I bet she went through a lot of, once they found out who she was, you know, it's kind of like the whole, when a guy murders somebody, you know, they go after the family. It's like, what? You know, someone that's villainized in the media, they go after the family. You know, the sisters, the brothers, the mom and dad, the children. I'm like, what are you doing? They had nothing to do with them. So.
Yeah, interesting. It's, you know, and you see them, I mean, but it's like they haven't come to that conclusion that.
No, they can't.
Right, right. It's real interesting. These guys talk about their guilt and the one, it's interesting. The one is like, he was an animal. He was, but then he'll go back to, you know, how smart he was, but he treated my mother like garbage and had a girlfriend and went out with his girlfriend publicly and humiliated my mother and things like that. So the guilt of a couple of generations of Germans, you know. And you know what? And I think the time has come when, look, we need to stop holding Germany, you know. That was almost 100 years ago, right? The Japanese, you know,
we've forgiven them.
Yeah, we don't jam the Japanese face in it like we jam the Germans face in it. And honestly, we need Germany to rearm and get stronger so that we present a stronger front in Europe, in Western Europe in particular. And so we all need to get over it. But let me tell you, that I saw a number, and I wish I could remember, but I can't, about how much money has been made off things that say Nazi or Hitler or Germany. And the number is absolutely staggering. It's like, I want to say it's hundreds of billions of dollars that have been made throughout history on World War II and Hitler specifically. And so it's a story that people, you know, make money telling. And to this day, find different ways and to tell that story.
Hey, I just sent you another link. I want you to watch that. Tell me what you think. And talk about that Thursday.
And to profit from it.
This is exactly what this is about.
Oh, really?
That's what I just say. Sebastian Younger. Do you know him?
Yeah, I've had him on the program. He wrote the book.
So he talks about his experiences on why we soldiers, people, there's an embedded reporter talking about why we miss war, what his take is on it. I'm not, the guys at Restrepo, man, they suffered a lot, but you know, my inquiry would have been is why did you put them on a hilltop surrounded by the enemy? That looked down on them. You know, What are you thinking? You know, this is, we never learned, and we won't. We'll make the same mistakes in the next conflict if it's got, knock on wood. I mean, I know we're still at war in some cases, but I mean, a big major conflict. We'll make the same mistakes again back then. Hopefully not, but we will. And those mistakes will be, again, underestimating the commuting to war, because it's, we have the ability. We can commute to war. We don't have to live like the guys in World War II right on the front lines. You don't live with the enemy within throwing a rock. They're like right over there. There's no clear defined lines. You know, we push them off of this. Korea, Vietnam, even Vietnam, where people were talking about, you know, where they started to commute to work in Vietnam, but not as much as we do now. Even in Vietnam, they'd go out and do an operation. They'd stay out there for, you know, for however long the operation was.
Vietnam, especially in the hill fights, closer to the coast, they, you know, they came and went. But in the hill fights, I was men's town. They were gone for months.
They go live.
You know what, Mike? But I watched. I saw a showing of, I don't know if it was Restrepo or the movie he made after that, at USC, in kind of a limited showing, and Younger appeared there. And I remember watching it. I didn't understand, for instance, at one point they go out and somebody gets killed in the operation, but they're going to conduct a major operation to clear and then cordon and search and do some stuff. And they're up in the mountains, and there's no aviation on station, and I can't remember who could range them. And so, you know, most of the time when we conducted major operations, and especially ours was in wide open terrain, theirs was in close terrain, you know, which makes it more difficult. And you got to have something there overhead, you know, that's on station or something. They can get there quickly to support those guys, and they didn't. They start working that stuff up when they go bump into something, and you're just going, oh, man, come on, man. You got to do fire support better than that. They're hanging their ass out on those mountains, and you're going to conduct a major operation, and there's nobody overhead to help? It just, you know, you're just sitting there wincing watching it going, come on, please. And then, lo and behold, bad things happen, as you said, you know, making the same mistakes. And so, frustrating to watch. But he wrote the book Tribes, and I've had him on the program. And he's an interesting guy, because he spent much of his life covering conflict.
Right, and I get it, and I love it. But I think I have, my problem, and I know he runs into this, my problem with those guys are, they get to speak of their experience. They don't speak for our experience.
Right. And it's different.
And there's a difference. Yeah, he had his ass on the line. He hung out. He could have been killed. But he's not doing the killing. He doesn't have all that respect. He has one portion of it. Yeah, you get your ass in the line. He's partially the pig for the moment. Every now and then. He's not the pig every day.
You're in danger. Yeah, he was in danger.
Right. And this is the argument we used to have about females, you know, in infantry, was the argument is they're already in combat. No, they're in danger. They're not in combat. People look at me with that funny look and they're like, what's the difference? And you try, take that deep breath, hope you had your good cup of coffee that day, blood pressure, you're thinking about checking your carotid artery, make sure it's not pulsing out of your head, your neck. And you relax and you realize who you're talking to and you go, okay, the difference of being in danger and in combat. So, you know, for them to understand that, for a civilian to understand that is, a police officer, he's in danger every day. He's in combat every day. Whereas you get up in the morning and you leave to work, you can run into bad, evil, whatever, and you could pay with your life, but a police officer does it every day. Every car he approaches could be his last car. every person he approaches, every call he goes on could be his last call. That's combat. Living with it every day. Day in, day out. Danger is, oh, I'm going to go to the grocery store. It could be your last trip. Right? But by the sheer presence of you driving or anything like that, that puts you in danger. It doesn't make you, it's not a combat. It's not, you're not living with it every day. There's not the chance, that chance is going to happen. These guys, again, because of what they do and the variety they do, they're always in combat. So it's the same as a soldier. An infantry guy in 3-5 in the city of Fallujah, waking up on the streets, the sewer-ridden streets of Fallujah with dead bodies everywhere, and then getting shot at every day and going to sleep in the same place, that's combat. You know, eating one MRE and maybe some hot shot if they can get it to him.
Well,
that's combat.
I think the other thing relative to a guy like Younger, and he would freely admit most of this to you, that it's his perspective, not the only, and the one thing I do like about his documentary is that there's no narration with it. Okay, he doesn't shape the viewers.
No, you're right. Just, I like that about him.
Right. Yep. So you, when you watch those things, there is no narrator. There's right. Just the documentary, and you know, the other thing is that he can leave when he wants to. And he's
leave
not
at any time.
Yeah, and he's not going back, or he's not held, or he's not, God forbid, the E word extended. Right?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, when Mike and I were in I said this before, but when Mike and I were in Fallujah in 2006, right, there was a Minnesota National Guard unit called the Red Bulls who provided security.
120 mortars, too.
Yeah.
On base.
Yeah, they're an infantry battalion, and they'd been activated. So they go to, and the Army would go for 13 months. You were there for a year, and everybody went home for a month or 2 weeks leave, but it took you a week to get home. So anyway, so that's how they did the math. But if you were a reservist, you got activated a year before you went, and you spent about, you know, half to two-thirds of that year gone training in places outside Minnesota to get ready for this deployment to Fallujah. And then they got extended. They got fucking extended. And you just felt horrible for those guys. I mean, they had been away for a long, long time. And I want to say they got extended for somewhere between 60 and 90 days. And, you know, the thoughts that go through your head. You mean, I made it through all this shit, and now they're going to tack on extra time? And, you know, they almost got overrun at Pump House Barney down in the Zadon once. And so it was, you know, they don't experience that. You know, and then they then come home, be home for, you know, 7 months, and then go back again. You don't experience that, so it's different. It's the same thing, I think, Mike, you know, when you hear every Marine a rifleman, like, no, don't say that to me, please. Every Marine might get some rifleman training, but you're not a rifleman, because if you were, we'd grab you and your other truck drivers and we'd say, okay, go clear that block. What? I can't do that. Yeah, no shit, you can't. Okay, so don't say every Marine's a rifleman. It's an insult to every rifleman in the Marine Corps. You know, don't say that. We got it. We train you. We get you a little bit of training, but I don't like that. So, interesting. No, you know, here's an email. Mac, there's some really incredible stuff. I agree with you. The stuff that's in Band of Brothers is really amazing. The thing that struck me when I first saw Saving Private Ryan was the sounds. The sounds are identical. And it's weird sitting in your living room hearing those noises. I shut it off.
And the look, okay, you know, the scene of machine gun fire coming at you, they did it perfectly. You know, that's exactly what machine gun fire looks like.
Explain it. What do you mean?
It looks like very fast red bees coming at it. It's like, I mean, you can see the vapor trail. you know, coming towards you, splitting the air. I mean, you see a disruption. It looks crazy to say, but you see disruptions in the air. But, and it, you know, just, you can see when they get shooting tracers, looks like a fast bee that went by, a glowing bee. It sounds like that. It just got the buzzing noise. There's no snap. The snap is the sonic boom of a breaking the sound barrier. That's what you hear, that crack. But when they're close, you hear a buzzing sound. It's cutting through the air. It's like a ripping, tearing. It sounds like a bee. A loud bee and a fast bee and a glowing bee made of metal. But when they captured that scene when they're getting shot with the, and the machine gun fire is coming at them, that buzzing sound when it's going by, that when it's ripping through the air,
right.
Man, it brought, I mean, right now it still makes my hair stand up.
Yeah, no, were you here? To me, that was.
Remember that sound?
That was the thing I noticed. Yeah. And I sat down to watch Private Ryan, and I said, I don't want to watch this. You know, because honestly, yeah. It's too real, especially the depictions of people getting wounded and things like that. It's not like John Wayne in The Sands of Iwo Jima where he gets shot and tips over.
Yeah, does the heart grab.
Yeah, it doesn't do
spins,
anything.
Spins. Yeah. Does the key teacup spin and then falls down.
Right. That's like, if it could only be like that. Okay.
Yeah.
There is no struggle. There is no, I won't even go into it, but it sucks. And when you see them depicting it for real, it's like, hey, I'm out. Anybody want anything from Dairy Queen? Because I'm not staying here. You know, and then it's, I mean, honestly, interesting, like, I can't remember which one of my sons came up to me later and like, you didn't like that? I said, no, I mean, I think I would find it fascinating, but it's not very pleasant when there's, you know, certain memories attached to some of that stuff.
Right.
I got it. And again, that it is the most real, you know, Private Ryan, man, that is like, it's a cross between Spielberg and Sam Peckinpah in terms of, you know, that's brutal. Saving Private Ryan. And, but they're so well done. They're so well done that, you know, but again, so many leadership lessons that are awesome. Are awesome.
Oh yeah.
Anyway. All right. Anyway, what else you got going on today? Anything exciting?
No, but I want to make a correction on for this, for the record, to clear everything up, make sure everything's square in the universe. Henrietta was correct. It was a cracked manifold for my valve. So.
What? I don't. What?
Remember I was talking about Henrietta? The other woman that lives here?
Oh no.
We talk about the dampness, and I said, it's been a lot of rain. You know, it's cooling up.
It wasn't hydrostatic pressure?
No. So I drained the hole, I put cleaning everything up, and then as soon as I got all the way past the manifold valve, top of the valve, I see it spraying out, just like a mist on the side, and I'm like, son of a...
Not this. Anything but this. Anything
yeah.
but this.
Yeah.
Wait, I mean, but how does that account for multiple boxes being filled, though?
Oh, because, I mean, it's just over time, they just fill up, man. I mean, it's water coming out.
But one manifold, I mean, maybe, but both? I mean, one,
yeah,
box, one box,
maybe. I mean, it's a manifold, you know, where the valves for everything is located. So.
Yeah, but that's that box. But you said there was multiple boxes that had water in it.
Well, no, there's three boxes back there, and they're small. So they're each right. one's got its own valve. They didn't put it in a manifold box, like one big box.
Yeah.
Put it in three small ones, and they're all connected. So I was like,
okay, here's the next
anything
question.
Anything but this.
Did you actually?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
You did. You're going to
pay. I wrote out a long apology thing.
You're going to pay for that. For a long time. You know, the last time, remember you doubted me? And who was right?
Yeah, the one time.
The one time. And you're going to pay for it. So, well, you're to be commended for your honesty and your
I had to do it right away, too. I mean, as fast as I could. And geared out there, over the top. apology. You were correct. And of course,
how'd she take that?
I get the whole thing of, if you do listen to me back there,
here's an email. Norman Dyke stays in the U.S. Army Reserve, gets promoted to lieutenant colonel.
Huh.
Yeah, becomes a lawyer, and then moves to New Mexico and becomes a uranium prospector, something like that, and then moves to Switzerland, gets married, moves to Switzerland, and dies in Switzerland. Norman Dyke, who didn't didn't do well outside.
Ronald Speer, Norman Dyke, that's a line of guys.
Yeah, Spears does not do well in the Army after the war. Well, first of all, it's tough because there's so many guys there, and they draw it down from millions to, I don't know what the Army was, about a million, I think. And
oh, no way, more than that.
It was competitive. What was the Army? Size of the Army
way
in
more than that.
What year do you want to
say? Size of the U.S. Army in World War II. What is it?
Oh, I'd say 3 million.
It was
Yankees and
Red Sox.
Oh, 1940 Army is 269,000.
No.
In 1942, it's 3 million. 43, it's 7 million in the
and 44,
Army. 44. Holy shit! 44, it's 8 million. 45, it's 8.2 million. Holy shit!
8.2. And the Marines are 474,000 at that point.
We're half a million. We're half a million.
Look, in 1939, when the Marine Corps is 19,000 dudes. That's like the regiment.
The Army. The Army is 16 times the size of the Marine Corps in World War II. And no wonder that, like, and the Marine Corps, like, and then we unleash our public relations machine on the world, and the Army's looking at us going, what a bunch of idiots, man. What a bunch of idiots, and they're winning, too. They're winning.
That's 38% of all U.S. servicemen were volunteers.
I want to put
61% were draftees.
Hello.
Overseas service, 73% served overseas with an average of 16 months abroad.
That's amazing. That 73% of the 8.2 million. Now, again, that's on at any one time. So if you go through those numbers starting in 1941 at 1.4, what percent of those went overseas? What percent of, because people were in and out of the military, got wounded, got sent home, blah, 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 blah. So total numbers that were deployed, that'd be an interesting number. Keep going, Mike. These are cool numbers.
Combat survivability out of 1,000 was 8.6 were killed in action, 3 died from other causes, and 17.7 received non-fatal combat wounds. Non-combat jobs, 38.8% of all enlisted personnel had rear echelon assignments. 62%, man, were faced in combat. The average base pay enlisted, $73.33 a month, and an officer made $203 a month.
There you go, boys and girls.
We're not done yet. Look at this. U.S. military casualties in the war. So you look at, remember now, we're talking about, millions. So the Army and the Air Force, because they're combined, had 318,000 people killed. The Navy, 62,000. And, the Navy, lose a ship at sea, there's a lot of dudes right there. The Marine Corps was 24,000. Coast Guard was 1,900 for a total of 407,316. Merchant Marine casualties, died as POWs, 37. 5,662 were dead. 845 were missing at sea, or killed at sea. 4,780 were missing, presumed dead at sea.
Yeah, I think we could change the killed at sea to over 5,300 or 5,500. Yeah, killed at sea 800. What? And then right above it, missing presumed dead 4,780. Hello. Yeah, those are. I mean, some World War II by the numbers. And there's other sheets that you see that tell other numbers in terms of, like, amount of material shipped overseas. And you're just like, holy shit. World War II transformed the United States in a lot of different ways, right? You know, all these people that get drafted, mobilized, and sent overseas, they go to the East Coast, they go to the West Coast, they come back. They're not going to Topeka, Kansas. They're staying in San Diego. It changes the nation, right? Women in the workforce changes that. All the companies that it changes. Hershey supplies chocolate for sea rats and the American military. Lucky Strikes, cigarettes. I mean, it makes companies gigantic. Jeep builds the Jeep.
Well, everybody had the capability. Yeah, well, and this goes back to, you know, who the person to give the kudos to this is Henry Fonda. Or
Henry Fonda? Henry Ford?
Henry Fonda. Henry Ford.
Fonda was a good Henry actor. Ford. We could lay it at his feet too. He could yeah. Share in it. But
man. Henry, yeah, Ford, because of the assembly line, you know, where they could change like this, and Singer started making M1 grants.
Amazing, absolutely, positively amazing. When you one of the great one of the, if you ever want to read something that's really really interesting. Go ahead and check out. The industrialization of the American economy, the military industrialization of the American economy during World War II. It's fascinating how companies did this. You know, how the government intended to pay for it, where they got the workforce, and that this all had to be accounted for in the mobilization process. How many divisions, how much workforce got left, the requirement for women and minorities in the workforce, who was going to do what, you know, did we by the numbers need African Americans? And that was all factored into, I mean, it's honestly, it's, you know, mobilizing the nation and converting the economy. Fascinating, fascinating stuff, if you like stuff like that. But I do. And it's like you read about it and you're like, holy shit. And they had these war boards that you know, the War Industrial Board that made decisions about raw materials and how this would all be done. Fascinating. And then, to me, just as fascinating is George Marshall and trying to engineer a soft landing for this robust economy that we built. Well, now that demand is going through the floor as the war ends. So part of the Marshall Plan is supplying, using these factories to supply now washing machines and refrigerators to Europe so that we can help rebuild Europe. But it also provides the soft landing for the American economy. It's really fascinating. George Marshall does not get enough credit. As an American leader, I'm convinced it's the when you read about what he did, you're like, holy smokes, that's awesome the way he would connect these things. So.
Hey, I'm going to send you a link. I wish the Marine Corps had something like this. It doesn't, so that's why I was. You know, I know you're going to go like, what? We don't. I've already looked. So this whole thing is, I think it's off of. The website, the U.S. Army Museum in New Orleans.
Oh, you know what? I think they just broke ground for the Army Museum. You're talking about the D-Day Memorial Museum, because I know Spielberg, and who was the author that wrote Band of Brothers? Stephen Ambrose. I mean, remember when they dedicated that? It was amazing. But the Army, the success of the National Museum of the Marine Corps has inspired the other services. And,
well,
I mean, that's.
No,
thing is,
they're kicking our ass, man. Look at this website.
Well, yeah, but they're doing it after we did.
No, see, I'm. Okay,
oh,
so
are you talking? You're talking about. No, you're talking about the D-Day one in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Okay, that's different.
This one is. Yeah. No, this one's different, way different.
That's the National D-Day. Yeah,
music. But it also has, I just sent you a link. I wish we had something like this, because this one, you can click on, let's say, Pacific Theater and open it up, and then it gives you all the campaigns. This is only Army, all the campaigns. Click on a campaign, it'll bring up the actual map and show you the landing, the units, the history behind it. I mean, you could do a TDG on this stuff. You can go to divisions. Like, I can click on the 7th Infantry Division. Gives me the symbol, gives me all the commanding generals, all the campaigns that they were in. Then it shows me a map of what they did, their division chronicle, their history, and then their battles. I mean, this is amazing. 1st Cavalry Division in the Pacific. Mudge. How does it have a name though? Vern Mudge.
No, I don't want that name.
Cavalry Division fought at New Guinea, Bismarck, Archipelago, and Leyte Gulf, Luzon, and Southern Philippines. Yeah, this is pretty cool. If I click on a little number, and so if you go, there's like a, you'll see a campaign map of the first, like a campaign map, and then there's all these little numbers associated with it. You can buy these maps. And this is like an old campaign map of Hell on Wheels in Italy. Dude, it's freaking crazy.
Yeah.
Put it on premium paper or black frame or stretch canvas, and you can give it to somebody. I don't think I've never seen anything like this. This is pretty dang neat. They just kicked our butts.
I don't think that's the Army, though, Mike.
I don't know who it is. Are you looking at it?
Well, because I just saw something about the National Museum of the United States Army. The National Museum of the United States Army is planned as the official museum of the history of the United States Army. Can you imagine the shit that's going in that thing? I mean, George Washington shit. Yeah, this is the cover he wore at Valley Forge. I mean, that's the kind of stuff they have in their archives and shit. Is under construction just outside Washington, D.C. The objective of the museum is to honor America's soldiers, preserve Army history, and educate the public about the Army's role in American history. It's located on 84 acres of Fort Belvoir in Virginia. Awesome. Broke ground in 2016, currently under construction, to be open in 2020. I don't know why I just read an article about it. And again, the guys for the Army talked about going and touring the National Museum of the Marine Corps and looking at the numbers of people that go there. That is now a stop. You know, when kids get on, they do that tour of Washington, D.C., and they're, you know, when they're seniors or some year they go. The National Museum of the Marine Corps is now on that kind of things that those kids go see. So the numbers are huge. But the National, I wonder who National D-Day, is that what it's called, Mike? Museum?
No, this one's just called Army Divisions, armydivs.com. So let me read something to you. This is actually, you said this earlier. This kind of puts it in perspective for me. Divisions overview. Combat troops in the U.S. Army are classified the weapons and methods they use in combat. There are five types of divisions: infantry, mountain, armored, airborne, and cavalry. 91 divisions were mobilized during World War II. 68 of them were infantry divisions, 1 mountain division, 16 armored divisions, 5 airborne divisions, and 2 cavalry divisions. All divisions were activated in the United States except for the following divisions: the Philippine Division, Philippines, the Hawaiian Division, which was later renamed to the 24th Division, the 25th activated in Hawaii from troops from the Hawaiian Division, and the Maracao Division, which was activated in New Caledonia. There were 3 major areas of operation. Now check this out in the war. The Pacific, 22 Army divisions were deployed and fought in the Pacific. 22. We had 5 at the end of the war. And who took the glory?
Yeah.
The Mediterranean had 15 divisions. That included Italy and North Africa and that kind of area. And then Europe had 61 divisions. 7 divisions served in both the Mediterranean and European. That was the 1st, 3rd, 9th, 36th, 45th, and the 82nd Airborne and the 2nd Armored. 2 divisions were disbanded or deactivated before the end of the war. The Philippine Division was destroyed. That was, you know, the baton thing.
Right.
And disbanded. The 2nd Cavalry Division was activated and inactivated twice. And then 3 divisions never saw combat. The 98th, the 13th Airborne, and the 2nd Cavalry. And then it says, by June 1946, 74 divisions were inactivated. By June of 1946, 74 divisions were inactivated or disbanded, leaving only 17 on active duty.
Wow.
Within a year, they got rid of 74 divisions.
Yeah, it gives you some idea. A friend of mine, God rest his soul, he was a mean guy. He was a mean guy, but I used to have him come on my radio show every once in a while in North Dakota. And he said it took him a day to out-process. He came back from Europe, and I want to say that it was some camp in Wisconsin that's no longer there today. He checked in. They gave him a ticket. They said, yeah, you're on leave now. Go home and come back in a month. He took the train back. He showed up. He out-processed in 2 days, and then he went home. He said, I was done with the Army. That was it. They typed up my DD-214. I saw the medical officer, and I got back on the train the following 2 days later and went home, and that was it. So I couldn't wait. You know, he tells a story that's awful. I can't remember what division he was with going through Germany, but they're done. They're done, and they load the train, and they're heading out of Germany, going through, I think, into France to get on ships to go back to the United States. And their train collides with head on with another train. And like 70 something guys are killed. And he's telling that story. And, you know, he can't talk. You know, he's trying to tell it, but it's not working very well. And he said, you know, they had lived through all of that. They were going home. And some idiot who's running trains can't figure it out, and they die like that? He said, there's something that's incredibly unjust about that. But, you know, it's one of those things that happen in war and in the aftermath. And you're like, holy shit, like all these stories. Let me just read you this. If you go to the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, which is what Mike is reading from, is a private nonprofit institution. We have received federal, state, and private funds for initial construction and the ongoing Road to Victory expansion. And so what you're looking at is all done with private, you know, some public monies and grants and things like that, but it's all privately owned. The collections, a lot of them, were held in different places around the country. And the concern was that they, as, you know, as time went by, that if we didn't find a national place as a repository for all this incredible history, that it would begin to be thrown away. And so they got collections from state museums that were no longer in use. They had individual donators, people that donated archival stuff and stuff like that. And it has become an incredible repository. And they said all that and then the accompanying publicity just opened up the floodgates. Hey, my dad was part of this, and he has this. Do you want it? Like, oh, my God, are you kidding me? Yes, yes, yes. And so, incredible story of the National D-Day Museum. It's the National World War II Museum.
I want to go down there.
Yeah. Yeah, you should. I'm trying. I'd love to go down there, too. We should go down
there.
Hey,
have you heard the Battle of Hurricane Forest?
Yeah.
You know how many people were lost?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. It is not a famous battle, but when you talk to soldiers who fought in World War II in Europe, when you bring that up, they're like, "Yeah, that was awful. That was horrible." How many? Yeah. How many were killed?
Killed 55,000.
How many in around Bastogne? Do they give a number for that or Normandy?
No. Well, Hurricane is was something different. That was during the battle.
Right. No, for the sake of comparison, I just wondered where it ranks in terms of different battles of European World War II.
Yeah. This was under Hodges, U.S. First Army. And I'm trying to look at a map. So
55,000. There were 58,000 killed in Vietnam. Total.
Yeah.
Total, yeah. American KIA in Vietnam, 58,000. 55.
So Hurricane is...
In the Hurricane Forest.
It's not even near. I don't even see it during... beautiful area. They show pictures of it.
You know what I saw? There's a special about a guy who carried a... He was a grunt, but he carried a camera with him. He was a photographer. Have you seen it, Mike? He's in the Hurricane Forest. And he carries this camera, it's the most... I can't remember. God, what's the name of it? He's a Jewish, and he's Jewish...
No, I don't. I haven't read a lot about this.
Oh, this was I think this is another Netflix thing. But he was a grunt. He's an American infantryman, a soldier. Let me see.
There's a picture of a tank track still in Call Valley. This is recently. The tank was hit. The U.S. armored vehicle was hit and burned in the Call Valley just outside of Hurricane Forest. This is on the road outside of Hurricane. And the fire was so intense that it actually melted, fused the track to the road where it remains today.
I'm going to... I need to find this. He lived in New York City, right? And I think one of the things he also did is he took... and the way his kids found this was he never really talked about these pictures, but he told them the story about taking pictures of Joe DiMaggio when he was watching Marilyn Monroe do that scene where the subway goes underneath it and her skirt blows up. Mm-hmm. So they have that thing fenced off and they're shooting it. And so their dad talked about it. And then they went in, and then they found this box, and they started going through it. And then they, I think somehow or other, they encouraged him to do something with it. And then they made a movie about it. I wish I could remember it because it's absolutely fascinating. But he just had this camera in his kit. And he would see stuff and he'd take pictures of it, but he fought. And so it's very interesting, very interesting. So anyway. All right.
So the Bulls, you're talking about the Bulls, right?
I'm not sure.
Well, no, that was the Minnesota National Guard.
Yeah, the Red Bulls.
Yeah, so the Red Bulls in World War II were the Philippine. Oh, no, there they are. 34th Infantry, the Red Bull. Entered combat 1942, days of combat 500, the division, and total casualties within the division were 16,401. Just out of that division.
Crazy. You read it, and when you going home? When the war ends?
Well, these guys they landed in Morocco in November 1942, fought across northern, all the way to Sicily, and then landed at Salerno. Fought in Salerno, up to Naples, to Anzio. They fought at Anzio, fought in Rome, northern, and then the Po Valley, ending in the Po Valley in May of 1945.
Yeah, the Po Valley. That was a grown up event too. I mean, any place you find, close terrain,
straight up vertical,
and the Hurricane Forest with all the concealment offered by the forest and. Yeah, they said that you know, and the Germans, they were good infantrymen, right? So you give them something to, a way to defend and conceal themselves, and they're going to make you pay. And it was brutal, brutal. Yeah, you hear them when you hear the term. You know, it's amazing. It's not oft written about, or, you know, there's no movies about, you know, the Hurtgen Forest. You know, but if you talk to, if you talk to Army veterans, you hear the kind of hushed tones in which they speak of it. You know, the very solemn way they talk about it. Like, yeah, that was not good. That was not good. Yeah, you know.
So. Yeah, you know what? Go on this website I sent you. You can, like I said, you look at each division. I'm looking at 2nd ID, the Indian Heads, you know, other battles. I didn't know that the Indian Heads only fought in the Northern Theater or in North Africa.
That's it? They didn't leave?
And then entered combat in 1944, June of 1944 in Normandy. But... Yeah, oh no, then they fought all the way to Central Europe. Okay. You gotta read this.
No, that's, I'll tell you what, that's what'll be incredible. Like, for instance, I'm a huge fan of the National Museum of the Marine Corps, right? When you go there, it's really cool. And now they're building it out even more because of the public response and the additional revenue, and they will continue to do that. Okay. The Army compared to the Marine Corps, it's the Army. It's America's Land Army. The history and the stuff that they'll have in that place will be absolutely, it'll blow your mind. It'll blow your mind.
When you type in the same type of information, you get a Wikipedia article on the list of Marine Corps divisions. And how lame is that?
It is. And where did you find that link? That was connected to the National World War II site?
Yeah, it sent me that I sent you the link, right? The U.S. Army Divisions World War II. It's on the. I sent it to you on the.
We're starting to sound like Army fans. The
I'm using there as an example of they chronicle their history very well.
Yeah.
No, which I wish.
Let me tell you, look, we bag on the Army all the time, but, you know, Mike and I have both spent a lot of time, I can never, ever, I don't think, adequately articulate the courage of the dust-off medevac guys who flew for us in Afghanistan, the 1st Brigade guys in Ramadi, led by Colonel Buck Connor. I mean, those guys fought their ass off, and, I mean, they were... Again, it's a different culture. It's not the Marine Corps, but it's the Army is, you know, it's good. They're good.
Well, when you look at these patches, when you go to the page and you look at these patches, like this 43rd Infantry Division looks like a blue taco. I don't know where.
They have some crazy shit.
There's one called the Battle Axe.
They salute indoors. They have these little sayings that they say when they, like... You know, 3rd ACR, the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, I remember, is, they're the Brave Rifles. So when they stand up like, Brave Rifles! And you're like, when you've never been around them, you don't know what to say. Like, why does everybody say this stuff when they stand up and come and go in the rooms and things like that? And they look at you like, it's what we do.
63rd Infantry Division, Blood and Fire.
Hua, Hell on Wheels. Right? What is that, the 2nd Armored Division or something like that?
I'm looking at Army Divisions. So you look at, if you go to Armored Divisions, 1st Armored Division, I think, was it 1st was Hell on Wheels? No, 3rd. Old Ironsides was 1st. Hell on Wheels was 2nd. 3rd was Spearhead. 4th was Breakthrough. 5th was Victory. 6th was the Super 6. Man, a lot of ingenuity went out. 7th, Lucky 7th. And the 8th, Show Horse. So the ones that everybody knows is Hell on Wheels and Old Ironsides and Spearhead.
Right. But these divisions, and some of their symbology goes back, you know, you'll see it, some of it in the Civil War.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, shit, man. That's like, That's like serious history in the American military. So it's, you know, and then we do our stuff, and then you go and you're around the Brits, and the Brits have been around the world forever, right? Predating us by hundreds of years. And, you know, they're talking about the Battle of whatever in, you know, 1353 in France. And you're like, what?
You know, okay, so if you're listening and you had a relative, if let's say your grandfather, your father, somebody served in one of these units, if you go on this website, and like, I don't know if you're looking at it right now, but if you, Mac, if you get a chance, go. I'm looking at all the armored divisions. So I just like clicked on, what is it? The 13th Armored Division. Black Cat.
The Black Cat.
The Black Cat. And then if you look at the print, this is a hand-drawn print from World War II that is still offered today. You can buy it. And it is beautifully drawn. And you can get it, like I said, you can get it on a stretch canvas, or black frame. And then, you know what? Put a plaque at the bottom of that, a brass plaque with your grandfather or something, and the dates they served, and you can keep that in the family.
Yeah,
I mean, even if they're not around anymore, it would be a great tribute to your family.
If you've never done a, you can do a database search I'm not sure if it's the National Archives, because the repository before all this stuff went, you know, was scanned and went digital. The repository was a warehouse in Kansas City. It caught fire, and part of it burned to the ground. And records from like 1950 to 1919 for certain organizations were completely destroyed. But there's a chance that they may have recovered pieces of it, parts of it, or whatnot. And you can recover, you know, your grandfather's, you know, war record. And if you haven't done that, you should do that, because it's pretty cool.
And build a shadow box, put this stuff together, and then you can pass it down to the family. And, I mean, you know, well, my point is, you know, you have heroes not too far. You don't have to look very far to look at for heroes, for inspiration, people that overcame adversity, people that overcame, you know, things. I mean, you think about, if you live through the Hurricane Forest, you live through, you know, Battle of Guadalcanal, you've seen a lot, man. I mean, there's not much more life can dish out to you that you know.
Piece of American history. You are.
Yeah, you are. And your family's part of it.
Yeah.
You know, cherish that. Put that up on a wall.
Yeah.
Make a little area where you can, you know, show that off. Man, that's fantastic that they did this. I mean, I didn't know that. You got to look through this, though, when you get a chance. These prints, like I said, man, I mean, I'd like to get one, and I have nothing to do with these guys.
No, and I'll tell you, the prints are beautiful too. Over the weekend, my oldest son, he's out here working at Pendleton. A staff sergeant who was with him, a machine gunner working at the basic school. It's just a great, great staff NCO, or at least he comes across as one. I'm sure he is, but because you don't get back there, those assignments are pretty unique. So, he said he had a buddy that was assigned to the joint POW-MIA recovery as a PCS billet, not as a TAD billet. So he said, you know, he's going to go around the world and work on recovering remains. And, you know, it's just this solemn job, right, that somebody left this country in 1941 or 42 and is still not back yet. And that you're going to go there and find out. But what's interesting is all this, there's a lot of people that are retired now that help with the circumstantial evidence surrounding that. And they'll make vacation plans and go to these places and build a case that they're buried someplace there. You need to go find them. So pretty interesting with all the additional, now that we're so connected, all the additional information that is being come out and is collected to help kind of deepen and enhance our understanding of these events that went on almost, you know, going on 80 years ago. So,
yeah,
interesting. The you know what, Rudy tried to call, but he's trying to call on the line you're on. I'll get him on. I'll get him on Thursday, because I know that he had a grandfather that fought on Iwo Jima, and I know that he's He's got some letters, and we'll get him to come on Thursday. So anyway.
Yeah, when you get a chance, though, look through these prints.
No, I will. I love that stuff. I have a Ohio man. I have a Civil War print hanging in my office right now. One he sent me. I love that stuff. I love that stuff. Yeah, I'll tell you. You know, and one of the reasons, you know, if you see the combat art that's in, you know, that's in the National Museum of the Marine Corps, and it ranges from everything to beautiful oil paintings to, you know, to chalk drawings and pencil drawings drawn by Marines in combat. It's you know, the art that the Marine Corps has that was displayed, like, in Lejeune Hall and Quantico and all these headquarters and whatnot. This art is incredible. And, you know, now they have a central repository for the best of it, and pretty amazing. And so you can only imagine what the Army has.
If those guys that are Civil War buffs, also on this, part of two military prints they have on here that are freaking amazing. The history of the Confederate Army and the Union, history of the Union Army. If you look at the, if you go to that and you look at that print, it's ridiculously, so it, you know, it talks about the Eastern Theater, Western Theater, and the Trans-Mississippi Theater. And it shows a flow of how they, where they came in, how they melded in together, like the Army of Mississippi and the Army of Kentucky came together. And then you look at the timeline, the Army of Middle Tennessee, then they became the Army of Tennessee. They fought at Chickamauga, you know, and it goes through this whole battle and it tells you who's in charge, the flow of how the units melded together, where they were at each campaign. And if you're a Civil War guy and you don't have this in your, on your wall, you're not a Civil War guy.
And that was transformational in terms of the American Civil War is the first time railroads are used extensively to move combat power, to move assets in between theaters in recorded history. Europe would follow suit in the wars that took place in Europe subsequently, but the American Civil War sees some innovation to the use of railroads, and so interesting.
Yeah, but it talks, goes through this whole thing, the Army of Potomac, and then every... I have to look at this, like I said, more detail, because everything is broken down. Cold Harbor, how many people, casualties. Yeah, this is who was involved. And then what happened, it's like I said, the flow of how it all, I've never seen it like this. This is actually pretty interesting how it put together.
You know, and until you, one of the things that I'm hearing General Zinni talk about, pick a battle and learn everything about it, administration. Yeah. And he said it doesn't matter because all battles essentially had the same thing. It's different now, but we've always had to communicate. We've always had to do administration. We've always had to bury people. We've always had we've always had to provide medical assistance. We've always done motor transport, you know, or transport. And I did that with Gettysburg and Iwo Jima. And Gettysburg, you know, the battle is about half the story. What went on afterwards, you know, you can imagine the amount of wounded, non-ambulatory wounded that they could not take with them that were simply left there.
Yeah.
And you know, the amount of those guys who died from infection. And so it's the stories are amazing, absolutely amazing. Yeah, American military history. Yeah, so to Mike's point, deep dive on these things, and it's fascinating. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the cool things about the Civil War is, in fact, I'm looking at two of the copies of it, is because I have them underneath one of my monitors here to elevate it. But they're the official records of the war, War of the Rebellion, official records of the Union and Confederate armies. And it has the daily reports from both armies. And so when you can read what these guys, you know, their reports from those battles, both sides in English, and it's fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff.
So if you're Rudy and you're listening, they also have something for you. They got the actual World War II friend or foe, World War II aircraft recognition that they would give out to their pilots.
My grandmother had that. My grandmother?
I used to have the playing cards.
My grandmother was an air sentinel in Seattle, Washington during World War II.
Also, she had she probably had this print then.
she had the medal that she got, and she had that up in the house. What is that? It's a single medal inside a frame. That's my medal for being an air watch sentinel in Seattle. And Seattle was home to Boeing, right? Mm-hmm. And she was extremely proud of that. And she would tell you, yeah, this is what this looked like. This is what this looked like. I had my binoculars. I had a shift I worked. I was like, oh, man.
Yeah, but it shows you perspective of how big, like, a B-29 is to a B-17 to a B-24. B-29s are huge, dude.
The nation at war.
But the Germans, I think it's a big place. Yeah.
Not for long, they didn't. You can imagine Germans take on all comers. The United States, France, Germany, England, and Russia.
They fought over.
Cage match. That might have been, in retrospect, that might have been a mistake. I think we might get a little bit more than we could. So, anyway. All right,
man.
All right, have a good one.
I'll talk to you.
There we have it. Michael Musselman on an extended version. On an extended version of All Marine Radio. That's right. Not sure how it happens. It just does. That'll do it on a kind of an interesting, 3 hours and 44 minutes of radio this morning. First of all, having internet issues on this end, so we got on the air late, and then I've been told that the connection's intermittent, which means something in the pipe is amiss. So anyway, hopefully it'll be fixed by tomorrow. So don't touch that dial, Major General David Furness. Join the program. He's the commanding general, 2nd Marine Division, to talk about what's going on at Camp Lejeune. And, you'll hear him talk about the damage, like trying to get accountability, what the impact on daily operations on the base, which has kind of brought it to zero as they dig out of it, deployments, personnel sent home on leave or evacuated and just told to stay home. That being treated as quote unquote basket leave, which means you won't be charged for it and whatnot. So, him and then Nick Francona. Nick is the son of Terry Francona, who's the manager of the Cleveland Indians, and brought him on to talk about his career. And he's a ground intel officer, so it's a kind of a hybrid MOS. They go through the infantry officer course. And then Nick went to 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines, deployed to Afghanistan in the spring of 2011, and led his scout sniper platoon there. And so so he joined us. So it's part one of a series of interviews we'll do with Nick, and we'll begin to focus on the hiring practice of professional sports leagues. Major League Baseball, the National Football League, the NBA, the NHL. Do any of them have programs that hire veterans? So with that said, tomorrow, You're going to hear from Admiral Stockdale. We talked about this whole idea of not just coexisting with PTSD, but thriving with it, learning how to win with it. And Admiral Stockdale, kind of the eye of the hurricane in all of that. And so you're going to hear, in his own words, Admiral James Stockdale tomorrow, as we study another American hero. And he certainly was that. So, have a great day. On a Tuesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.